Hey, I'm Gina from Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm Jennifer from Bethel Park, PA.
Hey, I'm Alex from Rochester, New York.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate. Thank you.
I'm Jesse Thorne. James Brown wasn't just the godfather of soul, and he wasn't just the minister of the new super heavy funk. He was also the hardest working man in show business and a man with a few surprising friends.
I think why he connected with Nixon and at times with the Republican Party most of all is because he was an individualist. He tied in with that bootstrap mentality of doing for yourself. You can't trust anybody else, and I can succeed on my own was his philosophy.
It's Bullseye. This week, biographer R.J. Smith profiles Mr. Dynamite, the amazing Mr. Please Please himself, from a country wild boy with burlap underwear to soul brother number one. And then comedian Cameron Esposito reveals her rugged childhood wardrobe.
How many days a week should a suburban girl wear a coonskin cap? I went with seven days a week.
And I'll tell you why you should go where everyone knows your name. All that and more this week on Bullseye. Let's go. At the top of every program, Bullseye offers up some of the best things happening in pop culture right now. Today, we're checking in with our rock music correspondents, Daniel Ralston and Maggie Sirota from the Low Times podcast. Hey, Daniel. Hey, Maggie. How are you guys doing?
Great. How are you?
Hey, Jesse.
Fantastic. I couldn't be better. Maggie, I want to start with you and your recommendation. This is a song called Life by the band Summer Camp. I am excited by any band called Summer Camp. That pretty much gets me right off the bat. Tell me a little bit about these guys.
They're a guy-girl duo from the UK. They don't have much in the way of a catalog. They've got an EP coming out this summer that was written entirely on a piano. And it just seems perfectly poised to be a great summer song. Like if my barbecue was kind of winding down and I wanted to inject a little life into it, I'd probably put this on.
Daniel, speaking of life and fun records, let's take a listen to your pick. This is a song called Henrietta by the band Yesayer.
Yesayer is a band that, on the surface, always sort of did not appeal to me because I can tend to write bands off when I hear the words Brooklyn, dancey, and things like that. But the first song of theirs I heard was a song on the Dark Was the Night compilation called Tightrope, and I was just so surprised by the depth of the song itself. And I think this new song, Henrietta, has a little bit of that same thing where it's a really fun song. Again, like Maggie said, it might be something you wanted to put on in your summer barbecue, maybe on a rooftop in Brooklyn. But there's something else about it that sort of grabs you and hangs on to you for sure.
Daniel Ralston recommends the song Henrietta by Yesayer. Maggie Sirota recommends Summer Camp's song Life. You can find them on the Low Times podcast in iTunes or on the web. Maggie, Daniel, thanks for joining us on Bullseye.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Jess.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Fuller. He was known by many names. Mr. Dynamite, the amazing Mr. Please Please himself, Soul Brother number one, the hardest working man in show business, the minister of the new super heavy funk, and most of all, as the GFOS, the godfather of soul. James Brown went from a Georgia jailhouse to the top of the charts, and in his four decades of recording and performing dominance, he left a legacy that's unmatched in American popular music. My guest, R.J. Smith, is the author of the first major biography of Brown, which traces his life from a literal whorehouse to being the king of soul and creator of funk. The book is called The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. Welcome to the show, RJ. It's great to have you on the show.
Hey, it's really great to be here.
Any excuse to talk about the GFOS is what I have to say about that.
Mm.
I particularly enjoyed the part of the book at the concerts around the Rumble in the Jungle in Zaire, where he wears that GFOS jumpsuit.
That's a great era because, yeah, he had the jumpsuit and he has this kind of strapping cummerbund thing. he was getting a little bit soft around the middle. You know, he's middle-aged there.
This is like 76 or something like
that,
is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the cummerbund is like a foot tall.
I went to an estate, there was an estate auction and also a collection of stuff from the estate in a museum in South Carolina. And they had a room, it was one of his wardrobe rooms, I assume, or all the stuff in it. And they had, you know, a dozen of those cummerbunds in different colors, all GFOS. I saw in that room a knee pad, you know, an ace bandage on his knee that I assume he used every night when he hit the floor and did please, please, please. I had to really hold myself back from not putting that stuff on.
Well, I couldn't be a bigger fan of James Brown. I'm excited to get the chance to talk about him. Let's start with his roots, because you spend a lot of time in the book not just talking about James Brown and his childhood, but talking about where he's from.
Well, for starters, he was born in the piney backwoods part of central western South Carolina, really a rural, really 19th century sort of area. And, you know, when he died, he lived maybe an hour's drive from there. So I felt that to talk about him, I had to talk about that region. And everybody that comes from that part of the state has this amazing affiliation with it. It's one big reason why I think James Brown could be friends late in his life with Senator Strom Thurmond, an arch conservative, segregationist, not somebody you would think would be on the next square in the Hollywood Squares with James Brown.
If he was on Hollywood Squares, it would probably read Celebrity Racist Strom Thurmond.
Yeah. But they were Southerners, and they came from the same neighborhood, basically, within a short drive. And that matters. That really matters there. And they knew how to talk to each other. They had folks who knew folks, and that was it.
Tell me a little bit about the circumstances of James Brown's childhood. He was not a rich boy.
His dad worked in the – he took turpentine out of the pine trees when they were living in South Carolina and collected it in buckets and lived in turpentine camps. So he wasn't around a lot when James was, you know, 2, 3, 4. Mom was around somewhere. James always claimed he was abandoned by her, but actually what I found out was that she was around somewhat. I think James's dad was an incredibly violent person, as James would become.
And I think he kind of scared her away. But James blamed her for leaving. So parents weren't around a lot. He's living in a shack, sometimes with aunts or cousins. Sometimes he was taking care of himself as a four-year-old, playing with what he called his friends that lived under the shack. Doodlebugs, insects, were his buddies then. And he would eat greens he found in the field, whatever Dad happened to bring home when he came home that night or that weekend. It was not an easy existence, and it didn't get much better when he walked to Augusta, Georgia, as a 9-year-old with his dad, living in his aunt's whorehouse, taking care of himself. And in some ways, that's when he walked into the 20th century, when he walked into Augusta in the 1940s.
So where did music enter his life?
Louis Jordan performed there.
Cadonia! Cadonia! I want to make your big head so high. I love you.
This was like one of the top tiers of the so-called Chitlin' Circuit. So Brown would go to those shows. They had a talent night once a week, and his group, the Cremona Trio, won when he was barely into his teens. They did, I think, a Louis Jordan song, some gospel songs. They won a talent night, and Brown was hearing music at the same time that he was performing it.
So tell me about how a young James Brown ended up in jail, or in a sort of, as you describe in the book, jail was sort of a different thing back than what we might imagine. But how did that happen?
Well, it's funny. I was thinking about this today, that whole jail time for him. And he said something really interesting to a close friend a little later in his life that I always am going to wonder about. He said the police wanted him for other stuff, more serious stuff that he may or may not have done. And there's always been this rumor that Brown committed worse crimes than the breaking into cars that he ended up going to prison for. So he said that the police were out to get him for something he may or may not have done. They caught him breaking into cars, stealing soldiers and working men's clothes. He needed something to wear. It was literally, and this was a guy who would go to grade school wearing this burlap flour sack underwear.
Well, I mean, he was, living in a whorehouse and, stealing clothes to wear is about as close to a wild boy as you could possibly be and still be living in a 20th century American city.
Mm.
Just being somewhere where even if the food was gruel, you could expect food.
That's right.
Is a huge difference.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was a expectation is exactly right. He knew he was going to get sleep that night. He knew that he was going to get fed the next morning. He had a radio. They called him Music Box in prison. He formed a gospel group in prison.
I don't get the impression that he was driven to form a gospel group because of his faith as much as because that was the type of group that you formed if you wanted to get singing gigs.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's exactly right. He went to a lot of different churches as a boy, as a teenager, and as an adult. And he got, quote-unquote, got religion in a more formal, affiliated way later on in his life. But he went to a lot of different churches, and he often said, or at least once said, that he studied these preachers. He, even as a kid, was studying how artists or speakers or performers connected with audiences. And he went there almost as more than a devout person. I think he went there as a student of communication and rhetoric and connecting. And he learned a lot that way.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the writer R.J. Smith. He's written a biography of the minister of the new super heavy funk, James Brown. It covers his roots in Georgia and his path to becoming a pop culture icon. I think one of the most interesting things about what was happening in pop music at that time, especially black pop music, was that it became possible to make secular popular music for young people as a career. I mean, I think that's the great revolution of rock and roll is, fancy pop singers were singing to older people, grown-ups, people with money, and, gospel singers were singing gospel music. And, you know, just like with Sam Cooke or whoever else, you realize, oh, wait, you can actually pack a show full of teenagers and sell records to 20-year-olds. That's very different from what a, you know, Perry Como can do.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. I mean, in the 50s, when he was breaking through on the so-called Chitlin' circuit, you know, those were working class, tough, grown-up African-American audiences. They told you when they liked something. They let you know with their words, with things they threw or didn't throw, if they didn't like things. If you suddenly didn't do a song they expected, you know, their fists might fly. It was a really grown-up scene that he was singing rhythm and blues to. And a few years later, after things like Live at the Apollo and the Tammy Show, when America can see him, he's doing those same songs to teenage audiences, white and black. And it's a whole different vibe, but he's the same performer.
What were the first records that he recorded?
Now, Please, 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 1956. There's always been a legend of an earlier recording, but that's certainly the first one.
Please, please, please. Please.
And that was a big hit for him. If he hadn't had a hit right off the top, he might not have had a follow-up or a career.
I love you so. Baby, you did me wrong.
It's kind of like a set piece or a found object or something. It was this structure that a lot of songs had, and that triplet, piano triplet thing that kind of is the whole rhythm for the song, and the vocal style. You know, it's the street corner vocal harmony style of a million and one records, and it goes back to gospel quartets and stuff.
Please, 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 please.
Took it places it had never gone before. He performed it night after night in these clubs and worked up an amazing, you know, could be a 20-minute routine, crawling around on his hands and knees. He'd get off the stage and crawl through the audiences. He'd find a pretty girl and he'd beg her, please, please, please come back, baby. He just pushed. He pushed and pushed and pushed with that song. He's this live, animated object, and he's burning.
After a break, more with R.J. Smith on James Brown and what Mr. Dynamite took from his predecessors.
He always presented himself as, quote-unquote, a man's man, but he got his hair from Little Richard. He got a great song from Billy Wright. He took influence and notice of everybody.
It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. Bullseye is supported by donations from listeners like you at MaximumFun.org/donate. And by Comedy Bang Bang, Friday nights at 10, 9 Central on IFC. Comedy so nice they banged it twice. This week, Scott Aukerman joined by guest Elizabeth Banks, plus smooth jazz legend Barry R. That's on Comedy Bang Bang, Friday nights at 10, 9 Central on IFC.
Hey guys, Nick White here. I work on the show. So it's been about 6 months since we've transitioned The Sound of Young America into Bullseye. We are really excited about the new format. We're proud of it. We're bringing you all kinds of new content. But we really do want to know what you guys think about 6 months in. So we've put together a really, really quick survey. It won't take long at all to do, but it will really help us know what you guys are thinking about the new show. So go to MaximumFun.org/Bullseye Survey and let us know. Please? Thanks.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, R.J. Smith, is the author of a biography of James Brown, the musician and bandleader, the godfather of soul, who helped shape the face of modern popular music. I want to circle back to one of his influences that you write really extensively about in the book, and really fascinatingly, and that's Little Richard.
Mm.
Little Richard followed in Louis Jordan's footsteps as the king of screaming in popular music.
Yeah. Little Richard, when he was not a star, came to this town, Toccoa, Georgia, which is where Brown had lived when he got out of prison, a small town up in the mountains, northern Georgia. Little Richard was playing there. Brown and the Flames asked if they could come on stage and play with him, and he knew better than to turn his stage over to anybody. But he did say, when I take a break, you guys can come on and play for a few minutes then. He liked what he heard. He gave them the number of his manager, Clint Brantley, in Macon, Georgia, big town. And in a few months, they were all living in Macon, Georgia, with the same manager. He definitely was somebody that Brown was studying very closely. They went, you know, he got his hair very clearly from people like Little Richard and Little Richard. And this whole amazing tradition in the South, that it's been called the Tent Show Queen tradition. A singer named Billy Wright in Atlanta.
Yay, 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 talk about mercy. Tell me what the mercy is.
A gay man, he had his hair up that way before Little Richard did. And other figures, Escarita, an amazing piano player, taught Little Richard some things and had a high gospel-y whoop that Little Richard inherited. Shake it like that. All these people are in the clubs and doing the same sort of things, and there's an influence there on, surprisingly, maybe not so surprisingly, on James Brown, you know, who, well, he's not a tent show queen. He always presented himself as, quote-unquote, a man's man, but he got his hair from Little Richard. He got a great song from Billy Wright. He took influence and notice of everybody.
There was a great turning point in James Brown's career that you write about wonderfully in the book, and that is he had been putting out this series of follow-up records to Please Please and had not, you know, he'd had minor hits but was not smashing with anything until he recorded an LP that he had to really fight for, which was his first Live at the Apollo recording.
Yeah.
Can't believe me, I'm crazy. Cause I love you, love you, oh, I love you too much. If you're with me.
It is like being in church. Sometimes in that record, when he is going back and forth with a totally intimate relationship with the audience, people shouting out, he's hearing that and feeding off that energy, shouting back at them, going back and forth. It's so much richer and more. It's something different than a record. It's being in a place that is not like a living room or a jukebox or somewhere.
I want to hear you scream. I want to hear you say, ow! I want to hear you say, ow! Don't just say, ow, say, ow! And I believe my word will be done. Ow! Ow! I love it.
You can hear his control over people. He lived this dangerous life, and he had so little control as a kid. And I think being alive on the stage and having this amazing, magical power over people in the audience kept him alive in a way, and you can hear it on the Live at the Apollo record.
It's around this time that he is really starting to develop this sort of, in 2012 terms, nutty business model. In his relationship with his record label and his touring, which involved, among other things, just carrying around boxes full of money.
Yeah.
But also involved a sort of, it's funny because to say that it's a feudal relationship with his record label makes it sound like the record label was controlling him. But what's remarkable about it is that he has essentially, through sheer force of will and intelligence and, I guess you would say, street smarts, twisted around that into something where he is somehow in charge.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. He was a fighter, and Sid Nathan was a fighter. And why they worked so well together, I think, was because they had this awful marriage where they shouted and all but came to fisticuffs. They never did, but they shouted, and they kind of respected each other. And stubbornness, Brown respected stubbornness, and he rose to the occasion and became more stubborn. the relationship with Nathan was like he constantly – Brown wasn't getting paid a lot. The way that he made most of his money was from those shows, not the hits. He would take shoe boxes and cardboard boxes of money and have different guys carry it. He had rolls of bills in the toes of his boots. But he was always needing money. And so one thing that would happen was Nathan would say, well, I'll tell you what, I'll loan you $5,000, but you got to sign another contract for the next 2 years. So he was constantly on the hook for more time just because he was always in need of more money from the guy. So in that way, he looks like a supplicant. But he knew clearly he was the hitmaker, especially as the 60s went on.
This is also when he's starting to develop what you might call his unique management style. he had been trod upon a little bit at the very beginning of his music career. And within 5 or 10 years in the business, he was very sure what he wanted in his organization.
On all levels, with band members, with managers and business associates, with girlfriends, he never wanted to be dependent on people. It's one reason, among many, that he had, you know, 2, 4, 5 drummers in the band at one time. Drummers were important, but he didn't want to be beholden to just one drummer. That was giving somebody too much power. So he always doubled up on everything, accountants and spiritual, you know, the Al Sharpton types. He always had a couple of political advisors. He always had a couple of drummers. So that he freed his hands, and he always kind of played people off against each other.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest R.J. Smith is the author of The One, a biography about Soul Brother number one, James Brown. So funk is this revolution that is often attributed to James Brown. There's a lot of disagreement about what the first funk record is, and you write a little bit about that disagreement in the book. I think there's relatively broad agreement that the first funk hit, the first smash hit record of funk, is Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. The world changed around James Brown as James Brown was changing. And, you know, the world of the late 1950s when he entered the scene and the world of the mid-1960s when he invented funk were very, very different.
His initial relationship was as an observer, in a way. The segregated system, especially in the South where he made so much of his money live, he didn't select it. It was forced upon him, and artists like him learned how to make it work as well as it could work for them. They played either segregated shows or strictly to black audiences. And when suddenly audiences were integrating and artists were expected to have a point of view on integration, it became complicated for somebody like James Brown, who wanted that circuit of black businessmen and record stores and radio stations that catered only to that audience that he thrived on and used to advance his career and have hits with. Suddenly it was dissolving as integration was slowly happening. But as well, people are expecting pop stars like Brown to have opinions. Brown came after the fact to that, and yet he seized on it to become a bigger star and to actually say things to people that mattered and that helped speak to the civil rights era.
Something that's interesting to me about James Brown in the social context of this period is that he seems like he is always driven by a desire to be the thing that he is and be successful at it. And that worked great in an era when he was operating in an exclusively African-American business and cultural environment. It did not necessarily make sense in the context of a sort of, I don't know what to say, I don't mean this pejoratively, but a sort of Sidney Poitier type environment where everyone is coming together. But as things continued to progress socially, he became that same quality about him made him this powerful symbol of what it was to be black.
Mm. If I hear what you're saying the right way, I mean, he was a fighter. I mean, he was obviously a boxer, and everything he got, he had to fight for. And every time he got more, it just confirmed in himself this idea that fighting was the right way to do things. So he performed as a fighter, which is why the Rumble in the Jungle, where he is almost equal billing with Muhammad Ali, is so powerful and meaningful. With these two great global fighters who had a political dimension and a creative dimension and a fistic dimension all in one place.
He didn't necessarily identify himself with the things that people were identifying him with, especially politically, in the late 60s.
Yeah. That's the other part of saying no that could be a problem for James Brown. I think, like a lot of us, he didn't have a straight and narrow politics. He had warring ideas that didn't all line up neatly. He believed in civil rights. He clearly didn't believe in nonviolence. he didn't agree with Dr. King's tactics, but he admired and I think loved Dr. King ultimately. He was critical of the Black Panthers and didn't truck with that. He thought separatism was going to be a big problem, but and then in the late 60s and in 1972, he sides very verbally and photographically with Richard Nixon, and it became a huge problem for him with his audience, white and black. And when people said, James, you're making a big mistake, this is a conservative, or this is no friend of the black man, or this is someone who doesn't line up in people's minds with Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. When Brown heard that, he went out there and endorsed him again, you know, because that was the fighter in him. And the you tell me no and I'll say it twice. And it really came to blow up in his face.
And also, James Brown was not afraid to, you know, have a meeting with Richard Nixon because he wanted something out of it. When he was in tax trouble for running an entire business based on boxes full of money.
Yeah. Well, he was hoping to get some things, I think, from the Nixon administration, honorable and business moves and stuff. But on the deepest level, I think why he connected with Nixon and at times with the Republican Party most of all is because he sided with that thread in conservative or Republican politics or Southern politics or whatever we want to call it, and they're all different things. But with that strain that has a mistrust for social programs, he was an individualist. He tied in with that bootstrap mentality of doing for yourself. You can't trust anybody else. So yeah, if I don't want a handout. Just get out of my way and level the playing field, and I can succeed on my own, was his philosophy. And we can argue, and I don't think Nixon really did that, but he spoke that language. He used those symbols to attract people like James Brown very successfully.
It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. Production of Bullseye is supported in part by Squarespace, a site for creating a blog or portfolio with over 100 templates and fonts using a drag-and-drop interface, offering 24-hour support and online workshops. More at squarespace.com/bullseye. The Memory Palace is a remarkable podcast about history. To imagine it, start by wiping away whatever comes to mind when you hear podcasts. podcast about history. Replace it with small, beautiful, fascinating stories. Things you'd never imagine and never expect. A sense of awe and wonder. Something amazing. That's The Memory Palace, the newest podcast in the MaximumFun.org family. Find it free in iTunes or your favorite podcatcher, or online at MaximumFun.org. That's The Memory Palace, the newest podcast in the Maximum Fun family. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, R.J. Smith, is the author of a biography of the hugely influential musician James Brown. The book explores Brown's multifaceted life, from music to politics. It's called The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. By the mid-1970s, the dominant dance sound in the United States stopped being the kind of noisy funk sound and started being something that was much more refined, not a representation of a live performance, and eventually became disco.
Yeah.
And that was a really tough time for James Brown, who had never... the train had never decelerated before.
Yeah, that's right. And the sad thing, well, there's a lot of sad things about that period, from endorsing Nixon and its after effect on, you know, but one sad thing is that when he made James Brown records, when he made funk records, they were really good records, or pretty good records, you know. But it was when he tried to make disco records and couldn't, or his heart wasn't into it, or he that's when he started to really sound less than we want James Brown to sound like.
What's that nickname that he had, the original disco godfather, the original disco man? Which
yeah.
one is it?
The original disco man. Yeah. Which is, you know, I mean, and
it's true in a sort of.
That's it. That's his point, was that, you know, this came from me, and a chunk of it really did, you know. Disco was different. Disco was much more steady on the 4/4. It was younger stars. It was more feminine and more gay than James Brown's audience identified with.
There was a significant portion of influence that was from people named Giorgio, not
yes.
people named Jabbo.
That's it. That's it. Yeah. He did not know what to do. I mean, he was the roadrunner going over the cliff, and running was always the default setting, right? That's what you did. You kept going. You were the hardest working man in show business. You always ran, and you always worked it out. And if you needed money now, you kept running, and the next show would get you some cash to get to the next town and so on. And suddenly, running didn't work. So the audiences were smaller, and the bills were bigger than ever, and the IRS was breathing down your back, and it messed with his head.
There's this point. He had signed a huge record contract with Polydor, the European record conglomerate,
yeah.
And there's this point where he's not making hits the way he used to. This is like 1976 or 77 or something like that, and he asks Polydor for some money, and they say no. I mean, he was in the habit of just asking the record company, hey, send me $25,000.
Yeah.
In fact, I think it was $20,000 for Christmas.
he had to buy some Christmas gifts or something. That was what he was saying. And yeah, he would always hold, not always, but one strategy, very successful and necessary, was that he would hold the next record from Sid Nathan until King paid him money up front to release a record,
Well, he tried that with Polydor, and they said no. And not only no, but you are contracted to give us a next record. And the people that you owe money are all hitting us with your bills. So we really need that record before Christmas. And suddenly he was not running things the way he expected.
When he tried to get out from having run off of the cliff, he did it by transforming himself into this sort of country guy. Not country music, but, you know, he had foregrounded his cosmopolitanness and his internationalness. But when it got really tough, what he did was drive a pickup truck and or a conversion van around his property in Georgia.
Yeah, that was to have a home base, to be a good old boy. Suddenly, not in a self-conscious or constructed way, or only halfway constructed maybe, there was a side of him that definitely was that way. I mean, that was where he came from. And as I say, that was why he could talk to Strom Thurmond, who felt that way to some degree too.
He had a career resurgence, as did a number of R&B musicians around the release of the Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
And, yes. I was born in 1981. I don't remember when the Blues Brothers came out. I remember it as something that I loved as an 11 or 12-year-old. It was a weird thing because it was the first glimmerings of baby boomer nostalgia at the same time as it was the first sort of hipster looking back on black music of white people coming into the mainstream.
Yeah. I think that he thought, thank God these smart Hollywood or Saturday Night Live guys got it. They got it right. I should be in movies. I should be singing in movies. And he kept running and he kept going. And he could be playing shows at the Lone Star Cafe in New York, for 100 people. Or he could be playing shows in Italy for tens of thousands of people at a festival the same year, the same month. And it was another show. He never dialed it down. He needed that vibe that he got from the audience.
He made that horrible record with Afrika Bambaataa.
Oh.
Peace.
Yeah.
Unity. Love. And having fun is the chorus of the song.
And I'm sure he didn't know who Bambaataa was at all. And there's no reason that he should have at that point, maybe. But he knew he was important, and that he was a spokesperson for something, and a guy making very important records. And he probably signified a little bit like Aykroyd and Belushi. Here's an important guy who gets me and is smart enough to want me to be in on what they're doing. But there you read these stories from the time where they'd have press conferences with Brown and Bambaataa, and it's painful because Brown is competing with Afrika Bambaataa, and he's trying to take him to school in front of an audience and educate him and put him in his place maybe or something. And Bambaataa is not about that at all. He loves James Brown. He wants to make he made a record, and that's cool. And it just felt really awkward.
So I'm not going to ask you to compare James Brown to like Stephen Foster or people from before the dawn of recorded music. but has there been any other popular music performer in the United States that has had the impact that James Brown had over his career?
You know, I don't think we can talk about Elvis. Maybe we can talk about, in a way, we can talk about Sinatra, I think, because the way that I see it, Sinatra, the way they come together for me is that he retooled himself so successfully from the 40s into the 70s. He found ways to make records that sounded good in that time, and that as his voice and his skill set changed, he made records that were perfect for what was happening with him and the industry. And they don't sound like the records he made 10 years before in any period. Brown very much is like that. And the only other guy I can think of in a way is Bob Dylan. with very different results. I mean, we love and praise Bob Dylan for being chameleonic, for changing with the times, and, you know, oh, he's born again now. Oh, now he's a fundamentalist, and oh, now he's you know, he's political, and now he's a conservative, and that somehow speaks to his protean nature. Well, James Brown was equally contradictory and conflicting and not in a straight line, but I don't think it always worked for Brown culturally the way that it worked for Dylan. Other than that, you know, George
because
Clinton.
Because of race.
Exactly. I think that's it. Because of race, because...
because what white people want from black people is authenticity.
That's it. Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's not ambiguity.
Well, RJ, I sure appreciate you taking the time to be on the show. It was really fun to read the book and to talk with you.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
RJ Smith's new book is called The One, The Life and Music of James Brown.
I don't care. About your thoughts, I just want to satisfy your thoughts. Oh, when you kiss me, when you miss me, hold my
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Moving across country is rarely smooth sailing, but so far, comedian Cameron Esposito has been taking it all in stride. Esposito was featured on this show just a couple of years ago when we were in Chicago, and lately, she and her signature haircut, the side mullet, have been popping up all over the country, from TBS's Just for Laughs Festival to South by Southwest and the Aspen Rooftop Comedy Festival. She's just moved from the Midwest to Los Angeles, and she wasted no time getting to work. On her first day in California, literally her first day in California, she trekked up to the San Bernardino Mountains to join me and 200 of the luckiest people on Earth, if I do say so myself, at the fourth annual Max FunCon.
I'm happy to be here in California. It really did affect me when all the Prop 8 proceedings were happening here. My biggest issue... Oh, I'm like a giant lesbian. There's like one or two people that are like, really? And everyone else is like, yeah, for sure. Look at those boots. So that was a crazy moment as a woman who dates women. That was a crazy moment because one of the arguments of the people who wanted Prop 8 to stay on the books, one of their arguments was that they didn't want little kids in schools to have to learn about the existence of same-sex couples That was the wording. That's not my wording. That was the existence. So it wasn't a morality judgment. It was, like, here's the thing. I grew up in the suburbs, and I wish to God, all right, how many days a week should a suburban girl wear a coonskin cap? I went with seven days a week. I just wish somebody had been like, listen, Davy Crockett, there's a reason for all this. I wish that somebody had to... That implies that there are no little gay kids. Like, that's what that implies. For kids to not learn about the existence of... Because... All right, so I've always, like, this is how... I've always been built like that. I love my body, but it's athletic. Like, I came out just, like, tiny jackets over tiny... Like, a Russian doll of tiny jean jackets, just skinny pants on. I'm ready for rugby. Throw a girl over my shoulder. I'll run the ball in. I've always been built like this. I've always been this person. I also, like, there's this picture of me from a Halloween. I'm probably 8. All my friends are there. My birthday is around Halloween, so it's like a birthday party. And my friends are dressed as, like, a gem or a cat or a nurse, like a Jemmy cat nurse. I am a bloody pirate. And I have grease painted on a beard, and I am sawing a pinata out of a swing set. And all these cat nurses are like, what the f*** is going on? Except for the one who's like, no, I'm into it. Because it's 1 in 10. Statistically, she was there. I also had to wear an eye patch for 8 years of my childhood because when I was a kid, I had crossed eyes. Yeah. When I say that right after the pirate story, there's going to be some people who are like, oh, like a black, like a pirate patch? Like a jaunty, like a thing around the head, like a conquistador, like a sailor of the seas. That's not that kind of eye patch I'm talking about. This seems like an intentional eye patch. I'm talking about it was a Band-Aid material, disposable, flesh-colored eye patch. So when you put it on your face, it just looked like more skin. Like a sloth from the Goonies type of a situation. To soften the blow, the people, the company that made these eye patches, they put in the box, they put these stickers. Because I think that they thought kids were going to be like, oh, what do you have on your binder? What do you have on your trapper key? Ooh, that like a Lisa Frank? Was that like a Lisa Frank rainbow? Well, check this eye patch sticker out. I think that's what they imagined, but never caught on. I think partially because it's genuinely tough to rock an eye patch. And I think also because they didn't even make the right kind of stickers. Like, they made these circular, bucolic farm scenes. It would be like a deer drinking from a brook and then an owl next to the deer. They were printed in only navy blue, tan, and brown. So you were supposed to, with your glasses, braces, bowl cut coonskin cap, throw a little deer on your patch and go and succeed at fourth grade. I just wish that somebody had said to me, listen, kid, your eyes are totally going to straighten out, but you are not.
Cameron Esposito is a stand-up comedian newly based in Los Angeles. She's appeared at comedy festivals and clubs around the country. You can find out more about her at therealcameronesposito.com. At the end of every show, we feature a culture pick from yours truly. It's The Outshot. It seems kind of ridiculous to recommend Cheers. I mean, everyone's seen Cheers, right? It's one of the most beloved TV shows ever. But I'm going to do it. I'm going to say it. You should watch Cheers. Here's the thing. Cheers is mostly just a perfectly standard sitcom. An ersatz family, in this case a bunch of folks who hang out at a bar, relate to each other. Something goes wrong to upset the order of things. Something is done to set them right. Repeat. That's been the structure of sitcoms since I Love Lucy and the Honeymooners. The trick of the form, though, isn't the formula. It's the execution. You have to want to spend time with these people, quirks and all. The jokes have to be funny and they have to fit perfectly into the characters' mouths. Most of all, you have to, as the viewer, care about this family. You have to want to be part of it. After work, when you're tired and your boss yelled at you and your spouse is annoyed at your smelly socks, your sitcom family has to be your refuge.
Making your way in the world today takes everything you've got.
And that's actually what Cheers is about. Cheers is about having a home, having a family, having a place to go, no matter how tough your circumstances are. A disgraced baseball pitcher, a simple-minded kid from the boondocks, an insufferable mailman who lives with his mom, a tired woman running from grinding poverty, a failed scholar, a psychiatrist who can't quite live with himself. All of these people go to Cheers not to drink or to work, but to be home. And no matter what mistakes they make or have made, they're welcomed. And the great part is, on Cheers, so are we.
You want to go where everybody knows your name.
That's my outshot. That's it for this week's Bullseye. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer, Julia Smith. Our editor, Nick White. Our intern, Lindsay Pavlis. Our interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally. Our theme music is Huddle Formation by The Go Team. Our thanks to The Go Team and their label, Memphis Industries, for letting us use that. You should like us on Facebook at facebook.com/BullseyeWithJesseThorne. All of those words in one long string to get special updates. You can also find us on Twitter at Bullseye, and you can find me on Twitter at Jesse Thorne. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off. Bullseye is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Hey, listen, before we go this week, we have a new MaximumFun.org podcast called The Memory Palace. This show is so wonderful, so amazing. I've been trying to convince its creator, Nate DeMeo, to join Maximum Fun for months and months and months now, ever since I first heard the show and burned through their entire archive in like a week. But I thought that the best way to give you a feeling for what kind of show it is would be to run an episode of the show after our show so you can actually give it a listen. It's really short. You don't have to worry that you're going to be stuck with it for a really long time. But it's beautiful and moving and wonderful. So anyway, without any further ado, here's a sample episode of the new MaximumFun.org podcast, The Memory Palace, called The Sisters Fox.
People said the house was haunted. And that was even before the two girls started talking to the dead. Kate Fox was 11. Her older sister, Margaret, was just about marrying age. She was 14. When they moved into the little house in the Nothing Village, 40 miles east of Rochester, New York. The girls had moved around a lot in their short lives, particularly in the last several years since their mom left their dad, when dad's drinking got to be too much. But now they're all together again. Their father seemed to be on the wagon for good this time, and he had found enough work shoeing horses to afford the rent in the little house in Hydesville. And he probably got a pretty good deal, what with the ghost and all. Their neighbors would talk about the traveling salesman who had been invited inside years before and was never heard from again. Never heard from, that is, until one night in March of 1848, when Mr. and Mrs. Fox first heard the strange sounds coming from somewhere behind the living room wall. Some nights it would sound like knocking, other nights like furniture moving, and it always seemed to be coming from the bedroom their daughter shared. Their parents would run in, hoping to catch them mid-prank. But when they opened the door, the girls would be fast asleep, and they didn't believe that their daughters could be tricking them. These were just girls. But they were tricking them. What started with a little tap-tapping on the wall, and tiptoeing back into bed, a hand over a mouth, a face in a pillow suppressing giggles, got more and more sophisticated as the nights went on. The sisters found that if they tied twine around an apple and tossed it across the room and quickly reeled it back in, the apple would skitter and skip along the floor and ricochet against the walls and furniture and sound an awful lot like the restless wandering of a murdered door-to-door salesman. And on the night of March 31st, the Fox sisters revealed the latest in their growing repertoire of ghost simulation techniques. They called their mother into the room and told her that Kate had made contact with the spirit. She then snapped her fingers once, and they heard a tap in response. She snapped twice, and it tapped twice. The next night, the Foxes and all of their neighbors squeezed into the girls' candlelit room and waited for the spirit. At dawn, the audience slipped out of the house, convinced that they had just spent the night in the presence of a dead man and two girls with incredible powers. Mr. and Mrs. Fox were scared. Their daughters could not stay in that room anymore, so they sent them to live with their older sister Leah and her family. Leah was responsible. She'd look after them. But they found that the ghost followed the girls, and Leah found an opportunity. Before long, thanks to Leah's management, the Fox sisters were selling out a 400-seat theater in Rochester. By 1850, the then 13-year-old Kate and the 16-year-old Margaret were the toast of New York City. People would wait in line for hours to buy tickets to see them, so they could ask the sisters to ask the spirit for word of their dead loved ones on the other side. The rich and famous would come backstage to meet the girls. The newspaperman Horace Greeley took them under his wing and introduced them to private clients who would pay the sisters to introduce them to the departed. Greeley also introduced them to New York nightlife, to the wine and whiskey that had nearly drowned their alcoholic father and destroyed their family. And in the pages of his newspaper, Greeley introduced the Fox sisters to the world. There were other mediums. There had been many other people who claimed to speak to the dead. But there was something about these sisters that people believed. They were innocent, pretty girls. And they were very, very good at what they were doing. They kept submitting to the challenges of skeptics and kept passing every test. Even people who were utterly convinced that this was all a trick couldn't explain how they did it. And everyone else, they wanted to believe. This was the 1850s. People just died all the time from diseases and minor flus and infections, things that don't kill us now. Their family members, their friends, their kids would die in childbirth, in accidents at work and at home. Why wouldn't they want to believe that those they loved weren't gone, that those they lost could be found? Soon people were holding seances like we hold dinner parties. They were putting their faith in tarot readers and mystics. Some were just scam artists, others were just wrong. They were just seeing things that weren't there. But all of them together were changing America and the way its people thought about death and life. And this modern spiritualism, that was Greeley's phrase, stayed near the center of American life for decades to come, even as it left the sisters who started it all behind. On October 21st, 1888, a 54-year-old Margaret Fox sat on the stage of the New York Academy of Music in front of 2,000 paying customers. And she spoke to the dead, and then she showed the audience how she spoke to the dead. She had recently lost her appetite for the whole business, and she wanted to get back at her older sister Leah, whom she believed had been taking too big of a cut for years. So she told the people in the theater about how 40 years earlier, back in that little house in that nothing town, after a few nights of knocking and tiptoeing and tying strings to apples, she and her little sister realized that they could both crack their toes. They could just tense their feet, and there would be this sound. And they found that no one could tell that they were doing it. And so people actually believed they were talking to the dead. And that was fun. She told them how they were happy to find out that that weird little sound could carry all the way to the back of a big theater. She told them how later, when they were famous, and fancy people would come to their fancy apartment on 42nd Street, a customer could be sitting all the way across the room from Margaret or Kate, and one of them would crack her toe, and the customer would be sure she was just tapped on the shoulder. Because sounds are hard to place in space, and because you'll pretty much believe anything if you really want to believe it. She revealed all of that. but not everything. There were some things that were private. Some things that maybe she didn't even understand herself. So she didn't tell them about how both she and her little sister started to unravel. Not long after Horace Greeley introduced them to the world, into worldly things like power and wealth and wine, things that had brought down people far better prepared for them than two kids from way upstate. She didn't tell them about how she and her sister struggled under the growing weight of their shared secret. She didn't talk about the times that Kate went further and further with her claims, moving beyond toe-crack conversations to moving furniture, to making ghostly hands appear out of thin air, at least in the minds of desperate believers. Or how she couldn't be sure how much her increasingly erratic sister believed her own nonsense. And that night in the theater, at the age of 54, she certainly didn't tell them about the time she tested her own belief. In 1852, the fame and money and parties brought a man named Elijah Kent Kane to one of her seances. She was 18, he was 32, and handsome, and a celebrated Arctic explorer. So she fell in love with him. And he loved her, but he didn't love her profession. He was Catholic, and his family was very Catholic. And there was no way they were going to approve a union between their God-fearing son and this godless woman who was spreading blasphemy. So she gave it up, and she and Kane began an affair. And they were happy for a few years. And she was sure a marriage proposal would come any day, until the scurvy Kane had been fighting for years finally killed him in 1857. Margaret didn't tell the audience how she broke down one night, despondent and alone, and tried to contact her dead love, how she tried to do for real what she had spent the last decade pretending to do. She didn't tell them how she called out to him, and how he didn't call back, and how she sat in the dark, knowing that he never would, and knowing that she would never be able to feel the comfort that the people who paid to see the sisters felt when they heard that their loved ones were at peace, or that they had been forgiven, or that they were always the one, of course they were, or that they would never be forgotten. Kate and Margaret Fox weren't forgotten, but at the times of their deaths, they weren't remembered fondly. Each died poor, neither living to see 50. The people who still clung to spiritualism were glad to see them go. And the people who never believed, they were too. Now, there's a postscript here that really can't be resisted. And you can do with it what you will. In 1904, they tore down that little house in that nothing town. And inside one of the walls, near what had been the girl's room, they found the skeleton of a man believed to be a traveling salesman who appeared to have been murdered a few years before the Fox family moved in.
That was The Sisters Fox from our newest Maximum. That was from our newest MaximumFun.org podcast, The Memory Palace. They've got a whole archive up in iTunes, and they'll be producing a new show for us every month at MaximumFun.org. They're short, they're sweet, they're beautiful. Do subscribe. You can find it in iTunes or on our website.